Okay, let us begin. Before we're going to be finishing with Eliezer Berkovits today, and we'll be moving on to Rav Chaim Ozer Gruzinski, who we'll spend a few classes on. There he is. We'll get back to him. I do want to respond. A couple people sent some interesting things, and I want to clarify something that someone asked me to repeat again, so I think it's interesting. I will. About the blessings that we say in the morning. Socrates, who dies in 399 BCE, so that's well before Chazal, he is reported to have expressed his gratefulness, I guess that's the equivalent of a bracha, that he was born a human, not an animal, a man and not a woman, a Greek and not a barbarian. I guess that corresponds, human, not an animal, would correspond to Shalos Aniavet. Man and not a woman, obviously, Shalos Ani Isha, and a Greek and not a barbarian, Shalo Asani Goy. And from there, if you recall, we got a little into a discussion about the Bracha Shalo Asani Isha, and I was sent, let me pull this up here, Yaakov Pronto sent me something. I have to pull it up from the content library here. Hold on a second. Interesting. I'm going to make it a full screen so you see it better. This is from a very old Italian sitter, and look about six or seven lines down. The version they have is Jasani Adam Velo Behema. Obviously don't have that. And the next bracha, Shasani Ish Velo Isha. Then we have Shasani Yisrael, and then it's self-censored, I guess, out. It would be a, you made me a Jew and not a non-Jew. And then that you made me circumcised and not uncircumcised. So notice, though, the positive form, Shasani Ish Velo Isha. Now let me show you a different example. Comes from another Italian sitter. If the Italians were more liberal on these things, but here's the one I'm going to show you now is famous. It's actually kept in the, you have it in the, it's a manuscript in the Jewish Theological Seminary. I'll enlarge this again also so everyone could see. Look at the version here. Little arrow here. Asitani, or Asitani, yes, Asitani, Isha Velo Ish. In other words, in Italy, at least in the people who use this version, they didn't have to worry about apologetics, Shasani Kirtsono or anything like that, because here you have a sitter for women, directed towards women. All these brachos are for women. We have examples of women sitter. Avadi Yosef has published a woman sitter. And she says, you have made me a woman, not a man. If this was the version that we had today, we would have solved a lot of the problems, especially since, as we pointed out, and Yaakov, I wasn't sure, I mentioned that the Torah explains the bracha of Shasani Kirtsono as being Matzdikes Hadin, as sort of justifying God that he made her a woman. It's not the best thing to be a woman. And Yaakov said it was in the Abu Dharam, and I didn't recall that, but he showed it to me, or he figured out where the source was, and I found it. So it is in the Abu Dharam. So that's that. The next thing. I want to get back, because there were some questions during the break. Oh, even before we get to that, something interesting happened in Israel today, and we've discussed this a number of times. And I always give this as an example of how orthodoxy, there's no real, you can't really pin down the concept of orthodoxy. It's more like a social construct that changes in every generation. And the example I've often given is when we were young, all of us, we knew that you never went up on the Temple Mount. That was what the UJA groups did with the Reform, everyone else. But in the last 15 years, it's become quite popular to go up. I'm going to show you a picture right now from today here. Largest group of rabbis, large even for you, 43 rabbis, because it's 43 years, the liberation of Jerusalem. And here you have, including the Rosh Hashiva of Har Etzion, numerous others. Just take a look at that picture. These are great Rabbonim, Rosh Yeshiva. It is obvious that it's no longer possible to say that Orthodox Jews don't go up on the Temple Mount. At 20 years ago, 25 years ago, if you told anyone that Orthodox Jews can go on the Temple Mount, they would say that's impossible. Everyone knows that Orthodox Jews can go on the Temple Mount. There's a big sign telling us you can't go. What else do I want to show you? When we dealt with Rav Henkin, we spoke about why do we need hashkachas on food? And I quoted Rav Henkin's point, because what's the issue? The ingredients tell us everything, and anything that's smaller than that doesn't have to be included in the ingredients, you know, tiny amounts, these would be batel b'roah. If they're batel, that's the law, they're nullified. So why do we need hashkachas at all? The whole point of the hashkachas, they always tell you, is made on this utensils, or maybe small pieces of tray, but if it's batel, it's batel. Rav Henkin pointed out the view of the Rashba, that all this is based on the view of the Rashba, that batel only applies when it falls in by accident. But it's part of the normal process of making the item, even if it's a tiny amount, and if you can't taste it, it's still regarded as treif. And even though the standard halacha is not in accordance with the Rashba, Rav Henkin says that we have to be choshesh for it. In fact, he doesn't just say you should be. His understanding is that if we can be choshesh, that is, if we can set up a system, we have in America, that there's nothing that goes in, even small amounts that go in as part of the normal function, and then we are obligated to do that. And therefore, if you have, let's say, two items, two potato chips, let's say, and one has the hashkacha and the other doesn't, you have to buy the one that has the hashkacha. That's what he says. Rav Henkin doesn't just say that if you know there's an item that is batel. He says that as a general rule, we have to use hashkachas when we can. And obviously, in places like Europe where they don't have hashkachas, this idea that we live in America, which again is the orthodoxy in America, the construct, the social construct of orthodoxy in America, means food item is not regarded as kosher unless it has hashkacha. If you're in Europe, they don't have hashkachas. So they don't have this whole concept that we have here. And we spoke a lot about bittul, and it was Pesach time, so we spoke about that. I'll get to the questions in a second. And I found something I never got a chance to tell you last semester, so I want to tell you now. It comes from the OU website, and they're talking about kitnios, and listen to this sentence. The OU, in their description, is totally contradictory, and listen to the implication. Kitnios is batel b'roah, which means that if someone accidentally put kitnios into their Pesach food, the food is b'dieved permitted, assuming the food contains more kitnios, more non-kitnios than kitnios. In other words, if by accident you drop some kitnios into an item and it's most of the food is not kitnios, you can eat it. That's the standard halacha, everyone assumes. And they say it only means if you accidentally put in. But then later, in the very same paragraph, they say, therefore, if a beverage is sweetened with aspartame made of kitnios, even those people who hold aspartame is forbidden, they drink the beverage because the aspartame is batel b'roah. And then it goes on, and he's speaking about this other thing called fenugreek. Even those who follow the strict approach to regard fenugreek as kitnios may consume apple syrup, which is flavored with fenugreek, as it often is, because it's batel b'roah. This whole thing is contradictory because these items, which I just mentioned, are not put in accidentally. They're put in intentionally. And according to the first part of this statement, it's only batel b'roah if it falls in accidentally. And according to the second part, it's batel b'roah no matter what. But the implication is amazing because if you assume, like the second part of the paragraph, that all these items are permitted because it's batel b'roah, and batel b'roah applies, and this is the standard halacha, even if it's put in intentionally, then there is absolutely no reason to drink kosher Pesach Coke on Pesach. Not only Coke, numerous items. Almost every single item in the supermarket, which they say you can't eat because it has kitnios, is permitted to be eaten. Now they have a special hashkacha, it says has kitnios. The only time it would not be permitted, even if it was less than a robe, was if beans, let's say, were actually individualized. And there are posts you hold like this, where Habadi says you can eat all these products. You can eat regular Coke, you can eat the rest, because the corn syrup is batel b'roah. But you have here in the OU's own description of Kyrgios, this is not the only time they make mistakes like this. The second part is in contradiction to the first part of the same paragraph, and according to the second part, there's absolutely no problem with eating any of these products. And then it gets even worse for the OU, because they talk about why certain products are Kyrgios. Quinoa, why quinoa is not regarded as Kyrgios, and why other products are not regarded, why potatoes. And they quote Ramosha Feinstein. Ramosha Feinstein states that those products that were not around in medieval times, only those foods which we know were specifically included in the minhag, we're talking about the medieval minhag, are forbidden. And that's how Ramosha explains the custom not to consider potatoes to be kyrgios, because the minhag of kyrgios dates back to the Ma'aril in the 15th century. Potatoes didn't come into Europe until the 16th century. So since they're a new vegetable, they aren't included in the minhag. Well, corn is a new vegetable also. And that's why Rav Abadi says you can eat corn. But other than him, I don't know anyone who says that. Corn is a new world vegetable. When the Columbus came here, one of the things they found, in addition to tobacco, which obviously is a bad thing, was corn. And then they brought it back to Europe. Well, if you say that something can't be kyrgios unless it's part of the original custom, then there's three reasons to drink regular Coke. Number one, it's batel barov. Number two, it's liquid derivatives. And number three, corn should not be included in the minhag to begin with. So that I think you'll find valuable. I have some other things, except although I see it's time to move on. That's something very fascinating from Rav Avadi Yosef. We'll get to that next week. Let me just answer the question. Yes, Ramosha Tendler goes to the Temple Mount every year. He goes... with these rabbis, it's not tourism or anything like that. It's about connecting to the spot. Remember, we go to the Kotel, but because we want to be close to the Shechina and things like that. But obviously, the Temple Mount is closer. The Temple Mount wasn't built by Herod or anything. The Temple Mount is the Makom HaMikdash. There also is a political element here in that they want to show that the Temple Mount is Jewish territory, not Muslim territory. It's ours. That's interesting. The whole question, Bill, about why we can say these brachas, Sani Kirtsono. This is a medieval bracha. Since when can we use Hashem's name? But the bracha Nosen Le'ev Kalach is also not found in the Talmud. Okay. Okay, let us go on. We are going to conclude now with Eliezer Berkovitz. We were talking about his views on the Holocaust in his classic book, Faith After the Holocaust. If you recall, I said last class that Berkovitz says that we don't need to explain why God brought the Holocaust, because God didn't bring it. Humans brought it. There were thinkers, as I said, in this very traditional view, who saw the Holocaust as a punishment for sins, and Berkovitz rejects this approach. People have free will. They perpetrated the Holocaust, no different than if I pick up a knife and stab myself. Just like we would say if I bought you, as I said, a new shirt. We wouldn't say God bought you the shirt, I bought you the shirt. So too, God is not responsible for this. I'm responsible for the terrible things I did to you. So the problem of the Holocaust really is not the problem of evil. It's the problem of free will. Why did God create people with free will? Now, presumably, there are important reasons for this. But once you assume that people have free will, for both good or bad, there is no longer a problem of theodicy with regard to human-on-human violence. Someone uses their free will, his free will, to hurt someone. That's the way the world is. That's the way the world is structured. There's no problem of theodicy here. We still have, obviously, the problem of theodicy for a baby born with a terrible disease. So maybe at the end we can talk a bit about that, but that's not the problem of the Holocaust. It was the Holocaust that led so many people to a post-God philosophy, a God is dead philosophy, not the classic issues of theodicy that we spoke about last week. Let us move on. Do we have dates? Yes, we have dates for the Italian Sidurim. The second one I showed you, which is the woman's Siddur, is from 1471. Well, it can give a lot of people comfort because then you don't have to justify God. But let's move on for a minute. See some other things. Because it's not as simple as it appears. So let's say now people have freedom to do evil. That's the way the world is created. Well, then you can fall back and say, well, what about God intervening? I think it was Richard Rubinstein. I pronounce it Richard Rubinstein, the theologian, the philosopher. Incidentally, he wrote his autobiography. You can read it. He studied at the Yeshivas Chaim in Berlin. He was at the seminary, and he refers very negatively to Shaul Lieberman there, but under a pseudonym, abbreviation, I forget now, but he describes his time at Chaim Berlin. I think now he regards himself as a Reconstructionist because he is an atheist. I think it was Richard Rubinstein who said that here's the problem. If God could not intervene to stop the evil, then he is not God, and there's no reason to have any connection. We're supposed to worship, we're supposed to connect with a God who's not an omnipotent God. What sense does that make? And if you're going to say, yes, he is an omnipotent God, that he could intervene to stop the evil, the Holocaust, which was the, for Rubinstein, is the terrible evil. He assumes that the Holocaust is worse than other evils. Although, as I said last class, I don't think this stands up philosophically. I think, speaking philosophically, one person murdered, a terrorist attack that kills 10 people, raises the question of theodicy to the same heights as the Holocaust. It's only, as philosophers would say, it's a question of kind, K-I-N-D, not of degree. The same good God needs to be justified if 10 people or if one person's killed as if a million or 6 million. But Rubinstein says, if God is able to stop the evil, and he doesn't, then there's also no reason to connect to him, to worship him, to be partners with him. So either there is a God, but this God is an evil God because he allows terrible things to go on. Who wants to have anything to do with him? Or this God is not omnipotent, is not able to stop evil. And that's not God either. So therefore, like Rubinstein, this means we're in a post-religious age. There's no post-theistic age. At best, he's an agnostic. There's no such thing as a personal God, no way to have a connection to a personal God. And really, you see this same approach, in Elie Wiesel's Night. You see a reflection of the second viewpoint. If you haven't read Night, I highly recommend it. Read it in an hour. If you have read it, it's good to read it every couple of years. Sold, I don't know how many tens of millions of copies. When Oprah put it on her books, on her show, made it one of her books a couple of years ago, and once again became a bestseller. But what do you see in Night? Wiesel never rejects the existence of God. What you see in there, if you recall, is he describes his journey from belief, piety, to disillusionment. In his youth, he describes how his life is dominated by God. And he even tries to bring about the redemption himself. And when asked why he prays, when Elie Wiesel is asked, he replies, quote, "Why did I pray? A strange question. Why did I live? Why did I breathe?" That's just part of his life. Of course he has to pray. That's a good Hasidic perspective. How can you live without praying? I think I told you once, Shaul Lieberman had a different perspective. Hillel Halkin, is in America, I believe, right now. He's speaking all over at various universities. He's on a book tour for his wonderful new book on Yehuda Halevi. But if you read commentary, the foreword, you know Hillel Halkin. In fact, I'm told that Hillel Halkin is philologos. He's the person who does the language column on in the foreword. He was Shaul Lieberman's nephew. Halkin's father was Abraham Halkin. And Abraham Halkin from the seminary, his wife was married to, well, was the sister of Lieberman's wife, both daughters-in-law of Meir Bar-Ilan. And Halkin would daven with his father at the seminary, where obviously Lieberman was. And he wrote this up a few years ago, not in the foreword, I think it was in commentary, in one of his essays. He wrote a few autobiographical essays. He talks about Ramaz. First he was supposed to go to MTA, and then he went to Ramaz. He describes going to summer Masad, I think it was Masad, Hebrew-speaking summer camp. And he describes how Lieberman once said to him, "Why do I have to daven? I don't want to daven. I have nothing to say to God. And besides, it takes away, it's Bittul Torah, it takes away from my learning." That's maybe a litvish idea. Davening is bittul Torah, and we've spoken about how many of these litvish they wouldn't daven with a minyan. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg mentions how he didn't daven mincha with a minyan. The only way I can explain it is because he thought it would take too long. There's chazaras hashatz and everything, and it takes away from his learning. But then Halkin mentions that, despite what Lieberman said, that he has no interest in davening. He has nothing to say to God. And Torah, on Yom Kippur, he'd be wrapped in his talus, and Halkin would see him crying on Yom Kippur. So even a cold litvak like Lieberman on Yom Kippur would show some emotion. But getting back to Wiesel, as the story unfolds, we see, and this is really the theme of night, we see how his faith was lost. He was not prepared to confront and come out whole with, to confront the concentration, the death camp experience, and the evil that it raised. He expresses, surely, a void, a separation from God, the meaninglessness of life, and the absence of God. He never denies God's existence. There's one scene where there's a gallows there, and he said, Jews are being hung on the gallows, and he says, God died for me on those gallows. But if you read, he doesn't mean that God doesn't exist. Not at all. God exists, but there's no reason to have any connection with him anymore because he's abandoned his people. Wiesel's God, in night, today I don't know what his views are, but in night, Wiesel's God is just like a father who abandoned his child. He's dead to the child, even though he's biologically alive. And really, this is much more tragic than a father who actually dies. People recover from a real death, but if you know you have a parent who's abandoned you, who's alive but doesn't want anything to do with you, that'll really screw a kid up for life, let me tell you. And this is Wiesel's predicament. He believes in God. He knows that God is alive, and yet God has abandoned his children. God does not care about the Jewish people. That's Wiesel's perspective. Berkowitz has a different perspective. For Berkowitz, the way to answer this problem of evil, the problem of God not intervening, because God can intervene according to Berkowitz, he uses an old notion that's found in Jewish texts, classic Jewish texts called Hester Panim. God hides his face. Our classic texts sometimes speak about this notion of God hiding his face, choosing not to be involved in the world. The Torah itself, if you look in Devarim, Deuteronomy 7, chapter 31, verse 17, it mentions God leaving the Jews, hiding his face from them. Yet this does not necessarily have anything to do with divine punishment. It is part of the nature of God, of the divine, Berkowitz says, that sometimes he hides himself, and we cannot understand this. The book of Isaiah, 45:15, speaks of, quote, God who conceals himself, who is also the Savior. Berkowitz says that this is a mystery, the greatest mystery of all. The God who hides himself is also the God who saves. Not at the present, really not at the present. People are being killed. But ultimately, he saves. Why does he hide himself? Well, he has to give people freedom. People need to live. God needs to withdraw. So the question, therefore, for Berkowitz is not, why is there suffering inflicted? But why is there man? God can occasionally intervene, but the general rule is he doesn't. And don't go into the things expecting he will. And the question, therefore, isn't why is there evil, why isn't God intervening? The question is, why is there man? Because by definition, man will have free will and will do bad things. Why would God create such a world? That's the fundamental question, and we can't really answer this question. God had reasons of his own to create this world, and inherent in creation of the world, it was that people had to have freedom. Creating humans who are automatons, not what God intended. It seems that God wants humans to reach heights of spiritual perfection, of ethical perfection, to do great things. And by definition, unless you have free will, you can't do great things because it's not great if you're programmed to do it. It's only great if you have options and have choices and choose to do the great. But of course, once you give people options, they have the freedom of choice to do bad. And for whatever reasons, this is the world that God wants, and therefore we must deal with this world. And fundamentally, there is no answer why God created man, answer that we can understand. However, there is an answer as to why bad things happen. God creates a world this way. And what's the salvation that I mentioned? That we see salvation, the survival of the Jewish people. Thousands of years, despite everyone trying to destroy the Jews, all these people who then end up themselves being destroyed, defeated, the Roman groups, which no longer exist. The return of Jews to the land of Israel after such a terrible thing like the Holocaust, that in and of itself points to the hidden God. God who remains with his people, even in the most difficult circumstances. So if you want to see God and his involvement with his people, you see it in the creation of the state of Israel. That's where you could say God showed, had an involvement. That is unusual. The Holocaust is normal. People trying to kill Jews. They've been killing Jews for thousands of years. Today we have modern technology. We have what they call industrial-style killing, so they can kill more Jews. That doesn't need to be explained. What needs to be explained is something truly miraculous. That the people, after 2,000 years, come back to their land, create an independent state. That is where we see God intervening in history. That's Berkovitz. That's really in a nutshell today in last class, Berkovitz's ideas in the book Not in Heaven. There's other interesting points of it. I mentioned that here and in other places. He really comes down very, very hard on Christianity. And I think it's unfair because although Nazism does come out of a Christian environment, Christian society, and there's a question that Christianity has a lot to answer for creating the grounds from which anti-Semitism could flourish. Nazism is a fundamentally anti-Christian phenomenon, and I just don't think he gives enough credit to those Christians who help Jews. I mean, he mentions them, but from his perspective, it's almost they were helping Jews despite their Christianity. They were helping Jews because of their own humanity, and yet the fact of the matter is that you have that whole town in France, that Huguenot town where they saved Jews, and many others who saved Jews precisely because of their Christianity. So the situation is more complex than he makes it out to be. Christianity has led people to do wonderful things, to risk their lives, and I don't think, if I could give one criticism, it's that in this book, Faith After the Holocaust and other places, his approach to Christianity is, I think, too negative and too harsh. Yes, we can judge Christianity and look at the record, but Christianity does not equal the Pope, doesn't equal the cardinals in Poland who are terribly anti-Semitic. Christianity is much broader. You can't even speak about Christianity. There's different Christianities. You have the Christianity in Poland, the Church of Poland. You have the church in Croatia, and then you have the church in other places, which had a much different perspective on Jews. The church in America, the church in the Scandinavian countries. So that's the only criticism I would raise. The last thing I want to mention about Berkovitz, I didn't bring up the page, I don't think, so I'll just summarize it, is keep coming back to the Brisker Derech, Talmud in Lithuania. In his article that I referred to about the rabbinical seminary in America, he speaks that he wants to establish, or he would like to see established, he speaks about the Brisker method and how this is really not the method that we need to train young people. It's for Talmudic scholars, and that's, he basically is wants to create a method of Talmud study that would appeal to everyone. Truthfully, I don't know if he's right on that either, because it was precisely, if you believe in salvation, it was precisely the Brisker method that was so influential, even in America, he thought. Since I don't have it, I'm not going to read it. And I guess we can stop now with Eliezer Berkovitz. And I'll take some questions before we move on to the Gaon, Rav Chaim Moisher Grzynski. Okay. I don't understand you, Shaul, your comment. You'd have to criticize the theology, connect the behavior to that. Please clarify that. Baruch, I'm not sure. I canceled my New York Times subscription 2 years ago when on Yom HaAtzmaut, maybe 3 years ago, they had the day after Yom HaAtzmaut, the day after the Israeli Day Parade, they had two pictures. One large picture on the front page in color of the Palestinian protesters who maybe were 20 or 30, right next to the Cherry Carta. We'll see them in a couple weeks at the Israeli parade. And then right underneath that, a small picture of the marchers were, and the people in attendance were probably 20,000. So times did that, I canceled my subscription except for Saturday and Sunday. So I haven't read Christoph. And truthfully, even when I was getting New York Times, I decided a long time ago not to read the editorial page. Literally don't even go to the editorial page. Of course, never read the editorials on the left side. But other than William Sapphire, who I could get online, I didn't even bother turning the page. So I could read Paul Krugman, what he has to say, and Dowd, just not for me. But if you could tell me what Christoph said, then I can say something. Oh, that's a good point. You're right. We Christians do the same thing. I work at a Catholic university. They always say that you cannot judge Christianity or Catholicism by Catholics. And for them, that includes even popes, if need be. We say the same thing. We don't try not to judge Judaism by Jews. Now, it is true, and all Christians will acknowledge that this doesn't take Christianity off the hook, because Christian theology about the Jews and other things have encouraged Jews. So they do say that. There's no question about it. I don't know if Jews are as honest to say that some of the terrible things Jews do, also you have to lay the blame, some of the blame, at Jewish texts as well. But post-Vatican II, the Christians have a much stronger case to say you can't judge the actions of Christianity, because the Vatican teaches something very different. And remember, Christianity never taught to kill Jews. They only taught to suppress Jews. So the Christians could always say that these people are killing Jews, they're violating Christianity, and the response obviously is, but if you didn't dehumanize the Jews, and didn't create a situation where Jews were dehumanized, then you never would have a situation like this. We spoke about a couple classes ago, this the bracha against the minim. And I mentioned that the early minim were never involved in collaboration or anything like that. I obviously wasn't referring to the 5th century, the 6th century. Once Christianity becomes the religion of the Roman Empire, they immediately begin persecution. Systems of government from Constantine on to oppress the Jews. How does Berkowitz view very good things of him? No, he doesn't. You have certain things like the state of Israel where you see God's presence. However, if what good things? If you win the lottery, he doesn't speak about that, but his theology is clear if you read it. We're talking about free will. I'm not talking about, by the way, he doesn't speak about non-human things. Theology of if an earthquake is from God, things like that. We have to extrapolate. As far as I know, he never speaks about those things. But in terms of human to human, just like you don't attribute to God the bad things, you don't attribute to God the good things. And truthfully, most what happens in the world, good or bad, you can find a cause for. And this is really very Maimonidean. If you look, not just Rambam, look at the Rishonim. They did not have a perspective that everything is hashgacha pratis. First of all, none of the Rishonim that I know of, I do not know of one early authority, including the Kabbalists, who believe that anyone other than humans are affected by divine providence. When Baal Shem Tov comes on the scene, the Hasidim have this conception that there's divine providence for animals, for everything. If your dog gets hit by a car, it's divine providence. None of the Rishonim held that position. And yet, even the Rishonim who hold the position that there's divine providence for humans, for example, the Rambam, it's not all humans, it's not all the time. Most of the things that happen during the day are just, they just happen. And most people are not subject to divine providence. The perspective of Berkowitz really has strong forebears in a complete intellectual tradition that ever since the rise of the Hasidic movement, they've been read out of the fold. And also because the simple person wants to be able to assume that everything happens from God. Although, from my own perspective, I think assuming that the world is just as Israel says, the world is created, things just happen, that is a lot easier to deal with, I think, than assuming that God is some puppet master. That Shaya Leibniz always had very strong comments in this regard. He once said that people who speak about divine providence in this way, they're big egotists, because they assume that God has nothing better to do than be concerned with the nitty-gritty of their life. He shouldn't speak that way, because the Talmud has passages that reflect this perspective. Nothing that happens, a person doesn't prick his nail without divine providence. But the standard medieval view is not that way at all. No, I understand what you're saying, Baruch. But there's no, I do not get a sense that he sees any value in Christianity at all. He sees a value in Christians, some Christians who rose to the occasion to help Jews, but his viewpoint of Christianity is so negative as to be unfair, I believe. In fact, Rabbi Ross Singer, Reuven Singer from Baltimore, he's the one who gave me the sponsum entering a church, which I published. And he speculated that perhaps the reason Berkowitz could conclude that as a tourist you can go in and see a church is precisely because he thinks that Jews have such an aversion to Christianity, that Christianity is so evil. Besides, no Jew would ever, you can never imagine a Jew going into a church and maybe being turned on to Christianity and finding it attractive. And Rabbi Singer says that perhaps if he didn't have such a negative view of Christianity, if maybe he was more sympathetic to the fact that Christianity is a powerful religious people, maybe he wouldn't have permitted going into a church, because you never know. Someone might go in and see the beautiful artwork and be inclined to investigate Christianity further, and one thing lead to another, and before you know it, you have an apostate. I don't know, obviously, if that's what's in the back of his mind, but it's certainly question by Rabbi Singer. Wiesel doesn't speak about really religion. As far as I know, Wiesel was never really a Shomer Shabbos. I don't know if he is today. He was always a traditional type of person. And I don't know if his theology reflected his practice, but he doesn't speak about religion there other than to say the conclusion of night is that God is no longer present in our world, a relationship between us and God. How can you be a religious person if you feel that this is a God, an evil God, a God who's abandoned his children, who has no connection to them, even in the world? But the whole point of mitzvahs is a connection with God. And at the end of the book, there is no reason for a Jew to have any connection to God. Yes, connection to the people of Israel, 100%. But no connection to God, because God has shown that he doesn't take care of his children. You'd have to read his autobiography if he discusses this, All Rivers Run to the Sea, and then there's another volume, if he discusses if his views of religion have evolved and changed. People have written a lot about Wiesel, so I'm sure he'll discuss that. But Night, which was published right after the Holocaust, published in Yiddish and then in French. In fact, the French version is different than the Yiddish version. Naomi Seidman pointed this out. The Yiddish version, the French version speaks about no vengeance, that after the Holocaust the Jews had no interest in vengeance, that they were done with their life. If you look at the Yiddish version, which is larger, and is supposedly, the French version is supposedly a translation, it's not. The Yiddish version has real vengeance. Apparently, Wiesel thought that you could not put this into French. Too controversial. And it would show that the Jews were interested in vengeance. Just to give you one example, look at the very last page. It talks about the liberation. He says that what did the boys do? They went into the nearest town to buy potatoes and sleep with girls. And in the original version, the Yiddish version, it mentions they went to town to rape German girls as an act of vengeance. But there's no more place for God at the end of night. God has abandoned us, so who has a connection with God anymore? I think, Edward Shapiro, I think, Father, I think obviously you can question the religion. However, there's no such religion. Religions are, to a large extent, created by people. You have texts that are regarded as holy. They're interpreted in many different ways. So if you have a religion, preaches, let's say, Islamic fundamentalism, that preaches terrible things, you can identify that with religion as the cause. However, you have other forms of Islam, just like you have different forms of Judaism and different forms of Christianity. So you need to distinguish between, you can't draw it in broad strokes. You need to distinguish between the religion. And every one of these great religions really have numerous religions. There's more than one Jewish religion. Religion of the Satmar Hasidim is very different than the religion, very different than the religion of the Merkaz Harav. Even if you do the same things, you're both Shomer Torah and Mitzvot, so the ideology is so different that in many cases you are really practicing almost a different religion, and it preaches very different things. So my point was that Berkovitz doesn't seem to, he doesn't really see any positive in Christianity, any Christianity. And that I think is unfair. You need to assume that some of these people can buy their religious beliefs. That's my only point. You could. Berkovitz doesn't deal with that. People like the Rambam wouldn't have that perspective. First of all, many of these natural tragedies we can now patient for. But if you look at people like the Rambam, the world functions according to certain Olam Kaminago Noheg, that God can intervene, but generally the world functions a certain way, and the value of a thing like an earthquake is what we get out of it, the things it can teach us. And you can even say maybe you could say it's a punishment, but that's not Rambam's perspective, and I don't know if it's Berkovitz's perspective. Eventually, I'm assuming we'll be able to explain all these things through causation. They used to think that when there were storms, it was because of God. They used to think that when there was an eclipse, it was because of God. Now we think differently. Modernity and the rise of science has, one of the major themes has been pushing God off further and further away. The Rambam already recognized this, and the Ravag and others. When you say things are from God, they don't mean that God causes X or Y. It means that God sets in motion the world. So God doesn't make the sun come up in the morning. There are philosophers who thought that every second is a creation from God, the Asharites and others. The Rambam says no. To say it's from God means that God sets it all in motion. It's been set in motion. What else are you going to say? That God does a miracle? If an earthquake's a miracle, then God does miracles all the time? Let's say that, but that's not the Rambam's perspective. Miracles are special things. And if you look at the commentary on the Mishnah, they're built into nature. Later on, he retracts that position, and he does believe in a more of an activist God, but the idea... if everything is a miracle, then nothing's a miracle, because God's doing miracles all the time. But for people like the Rambam, it was important to distinguish between nature, where things function according to certain rules, even if they don't understand them, and miracles, which remove oneself from nature. But sure, if you want to say it's from man's sin, that's very traditional. No, he did both. He was not speaking as an academic. He was speaking as a rabbi and a halachic thinker trying to change the culture of orthodoxy. That is, he wants the great rabbis to accept this. So he writes his book on divorce that we spoke about. He publishes his other articles. He is not willing to do it on his own. He doesn't want to split the Jewish people. He is willing to be radical in small areas. I think writing the response and allowing people to enter a church is out of the mainstream. However, all the other things he's speaking about, he says that these require the Gedolim, the great rabbis, to come together and either to institute it or to start deciding Jewish law this way. You don't need all the rabbis, but you need great figures. He himself, as far as I know, never acted in practice on this. Had he lived another 10 years, then he might have, because Berkovitz and Rachman were arguing the same things. And Rachman, until the 1980s himself, until he was in his own 80s, never acted on these proposals. And then he said, well, doesn't want to leave this world without having done anything, and he starts acting halacha maisa on his proposals. Berkovitz, he's a halachic theoretician, not acting on it. Even on his conditional marriages that he spent so long working on this, he wrote a book on it, he got Rabbi Weinberg's approbation, he never himself married someone with a conditional marriage of this sort. He had too much commitment to the Jewish people to split the Jewish people. That doesn't mean that he didn't think that the Orthodox world was doing a terrible thing and that the rabbis were closing their eyes. He thought that they were leading the Jewish people in a terrible direction. But you see, he couldn't change that. The rabbis themselves would have to come to see the error of their ways. So he was not doing it in practice, but he was not an academic. He is a rabbi and a halachic theoretician and a Dayan. He was a Rav of a shul. He started a shul in Skokie. It still exists to this day, so he was posseling for a shul, but not in any international sense. Yeah, but what does HaMachayesh Mechol Yom Tamid mean? For the Rambam, this means that the world is eternally dependent on God. And the Rambam himself explains that God does not create everything constantly. What does HaMachadosh B'chol Yom Tamid mean? It means that the world is eternally dependent on God. Incidentally, this expression, HaMachadosh B'chol Yom Tamid, is used by some people to show that the Rambam did not believe in creation. Even though that the Rambam tells you that he believes in creation. That's his exoteric view. Some people have argued, Ibn Qasbi, for example, that Rambam really doesn't believe in creation. He believes the world is eternal, like Aristotle. However, it's eternal in the sense that it's constantly created. HaMachadosh B'chol Yom Tamid. What does that mean, constantly created? It is eternally dependent on God. Ontological dependence. That's what it means, HaMachadosh B'chol Yom Tamid. Not that God literally creates the world afresh every day, but the world is eternally, Tamid, dependent on God. That is what it means. Do you have any connection with others on the Orthodox left? No connection with Lieberman and Halivni, and really, Lieberman was an academic. He wasn't involved. And Halivni was an academic, too. Halivni was just a Talmudist. Nothing else. So, probably about 15, 20 years ago, he starts writing his theology books. Leibovitz is the exact opposite of Berkovitz. Backman, and the American Orthodox rabbinate Berkovitz was involved with. He was leading Orthodox thinkers. So all the American rabbis, especially those on the left, he had relationships with them. He spoke at Orthodox conferences. He trained them. He was in Skokie for 20 years. So so many rabbis came out of were his muslachim. But he wasn't one to join together with others. The alternative method is simply a method focusing on pshat, on halachic rulings, not brisker analytics. I'll bring the text next time and up the downstairs. Okay, let's just move on. At the end, if there's more Berkovitz questions, we'll come back to that. But now we're moving on to really a great, great figure, Chaim Moshe Grudzinski. I said last class, and I repeat, he is really the only example of a Jewish pope in the 20th century, yeah, maybe even the 19th and 20th century. And when I mean pope, I mean, what is a pope? Pope, until he was forced otherwise by the Italian people, was not just the spiritual leader, temporal leader. Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski stands out, as we will see, as a leader, not just religiously, political leader, to a sense that in a way that no other rabbi has been, probably in history, certainly in the 20th century. You can't compare him to someone like Rav Yashiv or Rav Yosef because they only speak to certain groups. We'll see Rav Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, his influence, while not absolute, was much more important for the entire Orthodox community. Religious Zionists don't care what Rav Yashiv says. Rav Yashiv's followers don't care what the religious Zionist rabbis say or what Rav Avadya Yosef says. Rav Avadya Yosef comes closest to that. But even with him, there's large segments of the population that don't listen to him. Rav Chaim Moshe is also, I believe, the first Gadol B'Yisrael, great Torah sage, Gadol. When we use the word Gadol, it has a very modern connotation. they didn't speak about gadolim in the 19th century the way they spoke about them in the 20th century. And he's really the first in the modern sense. He's the first pretty much universally recognized sage and leader in a political sense. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan Spector played this role to a large degree. He was very much involved in politics, but Rav Chaim Ozer was even more central. Rav Chaim Ozer was also viewed as the last word in halacha, with the exception of the Ragachev, or really the last word in halacha in the 20s and 30s. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, although he was viewed by many as the last word, you still had plenty of people who took issue with him. This was the Netziv was around, the Beis Halevi was around, so I hope you agree with me, maybe you won't, but I do believe that Chaim Ozer is somewhat unique, if not completely unique. Let's also not forget that communication was not part of the century. Rav Chaim Ozer gave a decision or an opinion, immediately was telegraphed and mailed, and telephone even, and radio and everything. Talking about the 20th century now, in the 1930s, in the 20s and the 30s, the whole world very quickly knew about his decisions. When Rav Yitzchak Elchanan said something in Kovno, do they know about this far away? Do they know about this in Western Europe? If they find out, it's because the letter comes to them weeks later. It's not the same thing. He didn't have the same control and the same universal authority that Chaim Ozer Grodzinski had. Okay. Let's go on. Oh, well, one more thing. Agudas Yisrael. Agudas Yisrael as a movement only comes into being in the 20th century. And Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski is really the spiritual leader of Agudas Yisrael, and therefore his authority is carried over the entire Orthodox world, or much of the Orthodox world. Obviously, we'll see that people didn't accept Agudas Yisrael. Rav Yitzchak Elchanan never had that sort of organization. Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski was regarded as a leader for Jews of all sorts. We will soon see this. I think he probably wrote 50 letters a day. We have two huge volumes of his letters, and this is only a minuscule number of all the letters he wrote. I myself have published 35 letters, maybe, of Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski that I found. I have downstairs in my basement a number of letters of Rav Chaim Ozer I haven't yet published. And there are hundreds and hundreds of these letters. Unfortunately, tens of thousands were lost during the Holocaust. But he was an enormous letter writer. If you look at all he was involved in, it's amazing he found the time to learn and to write his story. If you examine the letters he wrote, these are not like the letters of other Gedolim. Any other Gedolim, the letters are about religious issues, they're personal guidance. No. Chaim Ozer's letters, they have that obviously as well. They have affirmations, they have ideological things, but even more so, they have him as a political leader. We'll see that in great detail in next class. In fact, in terms of being a political leader, in one area, I think he actually had his great influence was a negative factor in a way that no Gadol B'Yisrael today would ever have that sort of influence, and I'm referring to his quashing the plans to move the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin to Eretz Yisrael. I think in retrospect that became a terrible error, which negatively affected Jewish life in the land of Israel until this very day. And we will discuss that in a little bit of detail and compare it when Rav Shach and other rabbis in Israel came out against Grus opening up a building in Jerusalem. Who paid attention to that? No one cared about them. That's Rav Shach. He's not our community. So if we want to open if YU wants to open a branch, or if Torah wants to open a branch, we'll do what we want to do. He's not our rabbi. Chaim Ozer Grodzinski told the German Orthodox not to move the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. The German Orthodox listened to him. That is a man who has influence. And we'll return to that. Even those who were not Agudists, the Zionists, recognized the greatness of Chaim Ozer. The most famous eulogy on Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski was actually given by Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, the Rav. And it elaborates on the dual role that he filled. Rav Chaim Ozer Grodzinski was sage and political leader. When Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote this essay, when he delivered it and then published it, he was in 1940, remember, 1940, he's 37 years old, he's vice president of Agudas Yisrael of America. Rabbi Soloveitchik, who later becomes Zionist leader of Mizrahi, is at this time an Agudist. Had he remained in Agudas Yisrael had he not become a Zionist. He could have kept all his secular education. Had he remained in the Eretz Yisrael, he would have been the unquestioned Gadol B'Yisrael, Gadol Hador, recognized by everyone. He gave all that up, and he knew he was giving it up when he left Aguda. But in 1940, he was still a member of Agudas Yisrael and one of the leaders of Agudas Yisrael in America. Agudas Yisrael in 1940 was quite new. It had only been founded a few years before that. Until then, in the 1910s, 20s, early 30s, all the great Rabbanim, and these were East European Rabbanim, Agudas Rabbanim, they were all Mizrahi Rabbanim. He gives this drasha, Hesped, and it's called Bearers of the Tzitz and of the Choshen. And the tzitz, that's the headband of the high priest, and the choshen is the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. And the Rav explained that the tzitz symbolizes the intellectual and halachic aspects of Torah leadership. What does the choshen, the breastplate, symbolize? It represents the guidance provided by Torah leaders in general issues affecting the public. So the tzitz, the headband, that refers, and that's the head, the intellect, that refers to the sage's halachic guidance. Choshen, close to the heart, that's more the meta-halachic guidance, stuff that comes from the heart, the intuition, the so-called fifth Shulchan Aruch, that's provided by Torah leader in general issues. You really need to, you can be an intellectual and decide what the halacha is, but to understand these other issues that affect the Jewish people as a whole, you need to speak from the heart. And the Rav points to examples from his own era. Public protests against, how do we know if we should be publicly protesting against Nazi Germany? You need to go to the Gadol. You need to go to the one who not only is the halachic leader, but is the spiritual leader. How do we know how to respond to modernity? We go into a ghetto? Do we try to study secular subjects? How do we reach out politically? For these sorts of decisions, you need to go to the Torah sage. Just like in earlier years, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, dealt with halachic issues and also with war and peace and with everything else that affected the people, so too, this must continue today. The quasi-theocracy. Josephus coined the term theocracy. The ruler was God, but the Kohen Gadol was God's second in command, and they were really running the show. Rav Soloveitchik says that's the model of Torah sages. Model of the Kohen Gadol. He rejects the viewpoint. The Rav rejects the viewpoint that we have to separate the tzitz and the choshen. That yes, we go to the Gedolim to ask them halacha questions. If I want to know, for example, if this is muktzah, then I go and I ask the Rav, the Gadol. However, if I want to know whether I should support Zionism or who to vote for and all these sorts of things, that we don't need the Gedolim. That we decide ourselves. Rav Soloveitchik rejects this. And he says that on the big issues of the day, I don't think he was talking about voting per se, but big issues, ideological issues, we need to go to the Gedolim. Combine both of these roles, and Rav Chaim Ozer is a classic example of this. Rav Chaim Ozer, the Rav says, refused to let the modern leaders, by which he means the Askanim, the people involved in religious politics, the lay leaders, he refused to let the lay leaders take hold of the Choshen. The lay leaders always want, and this is the way it's always been throughout Jewish history, that the politics, lay leaders determine the politics. And the rabbi, his job is halacha. I already mentioned that in Italy, for example, the rabbi was not even permitted to put anyone in the chayrim unless he got the lay leadership's approval. Rav Chaim Ozer, however, shows the double aspect of Torah leadership. The religious, I don't want to say the political, maybe say the religious and the practical, or the religious and the secular, in quotes. The Gedolim, therefore, according to the Rav, are the authentic representatives of the Jewish people. What is this? What's Rav saying? Rav gives us in this drasha, in this hesped for Chaim Ozer, is the most wonderful elaboration, the most complete frail exposition of the doctrine of Das Torah ever penned in modern times. Aguda spokesmen quote this. Of course, it's a bit disingenuous, because the Rav Soloveitchik, would himself later come to reject this very doctrine of Das Torah. The Holocaust showed him that Das Torah can err and err grievously. But Rav's position here, expressed with reference to Rav Chaim Ozer, is the best exposition of Das Torah. And note, and this will conclude with this, He's not speaking of an organization like the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. The Aguda had their annual meeting, the 85th anniversary meeting, the other day. And they have a Moetzes Gedolei Torah. They appoint these people to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. And all of a sudden, people speak with Das Torah. This is a bit like the Vatican, because the Pope doesn't speak with his infallibility or anything, any authority, until he's appointed by the other cardinals. So appoint someone to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, and all of a sudden he speaks with Das Torah. The Rav isn't referring to this at all. There's nothing to do with that. He's talking about the individual. And the individual, the true Gadol B'Yisrael, the Rav Chaim Moser, is not appointed to such a position, but through his own personality earns the respect of the Torah world. Therefore, of course, he is the leader, and he has to be on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. But he doesn't become a Gadol because they appoint him on it. We've spoken about what happened when Moetzes Gedolei Torah appointed the Rosh Hashiva of Chaim Berlin on there. And Rabbi Karlbach wrote a letter, an open letter, which I can send anyone, to Aguda, how can you appoint someone who is, to this day refuses to listen to Hazmana, a calling? He's been summoned by a basin and ignores it. A basin by Moshe Feinstein. And Rabbi Karlbach says in his letter, if you can put someone on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah who refused to attend go to Basin when summoned by the Gadol Hador, then what is the Moetzes Gedolei Torah? Others have pointed out, this was certainly in Eretz Yisrael with Rosh Hashanah and the others, with the Hasidim, if you can appoint some Hasidish Rebbe to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah simply because he has 30,000 followers, well, he himself is not a great Talmudic scholar, that gives him, that's Das Torah? So we're not speaking, the Rav is not speaking about an organization here. Speaking, and Rav Chaim Moser himself wrote about how the organization of the Gedolei Yisrael is no longer run by the Gedolim. The functionaries started running it. Rav Soloveitchik, however, is speaking about the sage in its pure sense. And he's not speaking about a Gedolei Yisrael, even. But of Gedolim, his grandfather was opposed to a Gedolei Yisrael. Rav Chaim went to the first Gedolei Yisrael meeting and didn't like what he saw. Rav Chaim is the greatest exponent of representative of this Das Torah. And he had nothing to do with the Aguda and wanted nothing to do with them. So it's not organizations here. And it's not the Moetzeses or anything like that. It's the spiritual purity and Torah scholarship of the Gadol that makes him both a spiritual leader and also, to use the phrase, temporal leader. Leader for the Jewish people. I'm not going to go into detail, maybe if you ask, but as to what led to Rav Soloveitchik rejecting this conception, that's the whole story of why he rejects the Gedolei Yisrael. And we see a great example of the difference between centrist orthodoxy and right-wing orthodoxy at the RCA convention. How did they determine that women cannot be rabbis? They spoke to some poskim, ones they respect, including the most important, Rav Hershel Schechter. And Rav Hershel Schechter spoke about why he thinks this is a terrible thing. And then all the rabbis, 1,000 rabbis of the RCA, voted. And unlike other things brought up, this was unanimous, which means that either, not unanimous, everyone voted for it, but either they voted against women rabbis or they abstained. Aguda doesn't have that. Aguda, they put people behind closed doors. They come out, and that's the answer. The laity has no role whatsoever. In centrist orthodoxy, the lay rabbis or the pulpit rabbis, anyone who's not a Gadol in centrist orthodoxy has an enormous role. In the Aguda world, it's only the Gadolim. And as we've spoken about, when you speak about the land of Israel, there's no more a Moetzes even. The Moetzes hasn't met in years, and the decisions are not made by Gadolim. They're made by one authority. It was the Stipor, then Roy Rav Shach, and now Rav Yashiv, and after his passing, after Me'ad Esrim, they'll appoint another Gadol. So the Haredi world in Israel has adopted the model of the papacy, of one Gadol. Besides everything. In America, as far as I know, the Moetzes Gedolei Torah is still there. So you have a group of Gedolim, or rabbis, who are regarded as great rabbis, who decide. And for the RCA, the Gedolim only function as, unless it's a pure halacha question, but if it's a meta halachic issue, rabbis only function as giving advice, counsel. And then it's up to the rabbis as a whole to make the decision. With that, we will end. Going to spend. We have lots of exciting things to do with Rav Chaim Moser Grzynski, both halachically and also in the world of religious politics. So much happened during his lifetime, the rise of religious Zionism, the settlement in the land of Israel, the Holocaust, forward very much to dealing with them, especially because there is, to this day, no good biography of Rafael Moser Grozinski. There's room there for not just one biography, one doctoral dissertation. There's room for at least two or three doctoral dissertations, both focusing on his political role. We've had on Rav Herzog a few. We could certainly have on Chaim Moser. His halachic views, his political views, his role in leadership of East European Jewry. So there's a lot to do. See the questions here. You're talking about Eliezer Berkowitz. In that bill, I assume you're referring to Eliezer Berkowitz. He gave his proposal on marriage to Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein said, this comes from the memoir, that standpoint of pure halacha, Berkowitz is absolutely correct, but Moshe didn't want to institute it in practice for other reasons. Just made this light a little more so I could see the questions better. That's why you'll see me bumping off me. Lawrence, you said this sounds very close to the idea of Das Torah. You're right. And as I said, Aguda spokesmen continue to quote this. Rav Soloveitchik gave the classic exposition of Das Torah. Can't get any better than that. Rav Lichtenstein, in one of his essays, speaks about why Rav Soloveitchik also would abandon this conception. How do people get in the Moetzes? Just like how people get in the College of Cardinals. Other members of the Moetzes appoint them. Self-perpetuating body. There's no elections by the people. That's how all boards operate. How do you get on the board of directors of your local shul? It's because other people on the board put you on it. What it means, however, is you could have great rabbis who don't have yeshivas or anything like that. They don't get put on the Moetzes. About 50 years ago, the Moetzes made a turn, and it moved in the direction of Rashi Yeshiva. They concluded, for some reason, that the Rashi Yeshiva were more important than rabbis of cities or shuls. Until then, the Moetzes only had rabbis of shuls. They didn't have Rashi Yeshiva. Any of these yeshivas, Slobodka, places like that, the Rashi Yeshiva purposely were not involved in politics because they had to be above religious politics. The Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, they were not allowed to be involved. Because how can you have a yeshiva when you're trying to get donations from everyone, and you're supposed to appeal to all Jews to be identified with the political party. Obviously, that doesn't exist anymore. But the people who are appointed to Moetzes are either outstanding Torah scholars, but just because you're an outstanding Torah scholar won't get you appointed. First of all, you have to share the Aguda philosophy. Rav Herschel Schachter, I tell you today, is greater than anyone who's on the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. In terms of halakha decision making, I don't think there's anyone who seriously could argue otherwise. But he would never be appointed to the Moetzes Gedolei Torah. In fact, when he came to the Homolek once for the Aguda convention there, and Rabbi Scherer wanted to bring him up to put him on the dais, you know, he was just going as a spectator. And Scherer thought it was kavod that he should sit on the dais with everyone else. Rav Gifter got all upset. Not Rav Gifter. Who was it? It was one of the others. Got all upset, and it created a conflict, and they wouldn't allow him to come up because. He's not one of theirs. So it's not Torah knowledge only. It's also political views. And also if you have a lot of influence. You're a Hasidic Rebbe. Share the Aguda philosophy. It's Torah. It doesn't matter if not a Lamdan. Because Aguda Yisrael is also about moving the masses for Jewish causes. So if you have influence, the problem was, and Rav Shach discovered this in Israel, is that then you have great Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. We'll have to argue with Hasidic Rebbes over whether Agudas Yisrael should be in the government or not. And for Litvish Rosh Yeshiva, for his vote to be counted equally, for some Hasidic Rebbe who the Litvish Rosh Yeshiva doesn't have any respect for, and remember, we were talking about the Ger Rebbe, who was a Lamdan, but the Litvish Rosh Yeshiva, that for him, he's willing to argue with another Litvish Rosh Yeshiva, not someone who was put there because of that he has a large following. Rav Shach felt that he had to form his own party. And it's the same thing in America. Let's see. Rav Baruch Berger could say what he wants, but Rav Chaim, after the first Aguda, and I don't know if Rav Baruch Berger said it, it's the person who wrote this book on Rav Baruch Berger. Rav Chaim, after the first Aguda convention, never again went to any Aguda conventions. Rav Moshe Soloveitchik gave an interview, first saw paper. HaMizrach explaining why his father was so opposed to it. Rabbi Meiselman writes somewhere that the family, had letters from Reb Chaim Ozer asking Reb Chaim to come back to Agudas Yisrael. You can read Yaakov Rosenheim's autobiography, and he talks about why Reb Chaim didn't go along. Reb Chaim gave 18 conditions for his continued involvement with Aguda, and Aguda would not agree to these conditions, and therefore, unfortunately, these 18 conditions, Rosenheim said that he lost them. This would have been a very important historical document, and Reb Chaim never again, not only Reb Chaim, Chaim's son, Revelvo, all the Soloveitchiks in Israel, none of them had anything to do with Agudas Yisrael, and to this day they have nothing to do with Agudas Yisrael. They were opposed to Agudas Yisrael, and they still were opposed. And I do not believe for a minute Reb Baruch Ber said that Reb Chaim was pro-Aguda, because it was a davar yadu, it was a known thing that Reb Chaim was very anti-Aguda. Of course, he was much more anti-Mizrahi. He was anti-Aguda also. Just like the Lubavitcher Rebbe. They tried to get the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the Lubavitcher Rebbe wouldn't even come to the first meeting. He was anti-Aguda. I don't know, Bill, if you can... Oh, you're referring to Chaim Moshe Grzinski? No, Shlomo, if you can get me the evidence why they say the Reb Baruch Ber said he was pro-Aguda, this, as I said, was well known in Agudas Yisrael. That, of course, Reb Chaim dies shortly after it was formed at the end of World War I, but everyone in the family, their tradition is, and they followed it, that Agudas Yisrael, part of Reb Chaim's problems was the German. The Agudas Yisrael is really a German-started organization. There were other issues as well. He couldn't stand the separatism, that you could be a good old Yisrael, but if you weren't in a separatist community, they wouldn't put you on the dais. The best discussion of this is Yaakov Rosenheim's essay, his autobiography, in which he describes how hard he worked to get Reb Chaim into the Aguda. And as I said, not just Reb Chaim, but none of his sons, neither Reb Moshe nor Revelvo would have anything to do with Agudas Yisrael. That's why when Rav Soloveitchik joins Agudas Yisrael, it's pretty unique. Oh, you're from Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski. Who did Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski consult on the right, other than Rav Chanan Wasserman? He spoke, but we will see that he really disagreed with Rav Chanan Wasserman on certain important issues. So Rav Chaim Ozer wasn't turning to any Hungarian rabbanim. Who was on the right in his world, other than Rav Chanan Wasserman? I don't know. Well, what happened at the first Aguda is you had Rosenheim and you had Shlomo Zev Breuer, but they brought in some Gadol Yisrael, and then they picked. Of course they picked. They picked who they thought there were great rabbis that didn't pick. The Rav of Frankfurt, Rav Mordechai Levi Horovitz, the Rav of the larger community, was an anti-Zionist. He would have fitted very well with Aguda. The only problem was he was not a separatist. So although Rosenheim wanted him to be involved in Aguda, the Breuers would not allow it. They picked Lithuanian and Polish Gedolim, the Hungarians. They never were able to attract. And much of the Hasidic world, they did attract. Other parts, they couldn't attract. They attracted Ger. Ger obviously becomes very important, but not Chabad. We'll talk more about the politics of Aguda in the next class. The Rav does not say just if you're a scholar, you're automatically a leader. Not at all. You can be a great Talmud Chacham and not be qualified, but certain of the Gedolim, the true Gedolim, are the ones who have both these roles. And Rav Chaim Ozer was the quintessential Gadol. Rav Soloveitchik is speaking against this Mizrahi type of viewpoint that we need the Gedolim, but we need them to know what the Halacha is. When Rav Kook declared that women could not vote, that was a psak he gave in 1924, whenever, 21, whatever the Jewish agency elections were, Yehuda Leib Maimon said publicly, published it, he said, that when it comes to halacha, we'll consult with the rabbis, we'll consult with Rav Kook. But when it comes to how to live, voting, things like that, how to build a state, that the rabbis have to consult with us, because we're expert in ways of the world. And the rabbis, they're just locked up in their books. That was the Mizrahi attitude, and it remained the Mizrahi attitude. Rav Goren, chief rabbi, he wanted to create a Moetzes Gedolei Torah for the National Religious Party of Ravit, and they would determine the policies of the National Religious Party, just like the Agudas Yisrael takes its orders from their Gedolim. And the Mizrahi, the National Religious Party, told Rabbi Goren he can take a hike. that they don't function that way. Soloveitchik was speaking against this modern type of Orthodox view that we go to the Gedolim for issues of Jewish law, but not for issues of politics. And he wasn't even saying that we can go for them and listen to them, take advice, their advice. Even the modern Orthodox thinks it's good to listen to them for advice. You should see Rav Lichtenstein's essay on Das Torah where he speaks about this. Rav Soloveitchik is completely rejecting this notion that the Gedolim have nothing to say in terms of non-halachic areas, that we don't have to listen to them. But again, he's not speaking of your local pulpit rabbi or anything like that. He's speaking about the Gedolim. And when I say the Gedolim, there aren't 100 Gedolim. There is a few Gedolim in each generation. And we're not talking about self-proclaimed Gedolim. Someone who declares that I'm a Gadol and I have Das Torah, by definition, he's not a Gadol. Soloveitchik was speaking of people like Rav Moshe Grozinski. Maybe you only get one a generation. I'm at risk. That's the sort of person he's seeing. When you say his number two was Mizrachis, who's his number two? Rabbi Shub. You're talking about Rabbi Shub? I don't know who is... okay. You're talking about the based in the Marcheshes. Rav Chaim Ozer does not discriminate in that way. The East European Rabbanim didn't discriminate against politics. We'll get into this again when we deal with the election. Mizrachi and Rav Chaim Ozer. But you had plenty of cities full of Agudas Israel people that had Mizrachi Rabbanim. No one ever said that because the Rav is Mizrachi Rav that you don't listen to him halachically. Of course, the Aguda would go to their Rav, who was a Mizrachi, when they had to ask halachic questions. Came to ideological issues, they followed the Aguda. We'll get back to when we deal with the election. We'll get back to that. No, he didn't throw it all away to give speeches to Mizrachi. He threw it away because he had a belief, an ideology. How many people are hypocrites? How many people are willing to say things that they don't believe just for power? The Rav could have kept his mouth shut. He could have kept spouting the lines, and they would have turned him into the Gadol Ador. However, there was something more important for him, speaking what he felt was the truth. So he willingly gave all that up, as many Rabbanim did who were Mizrachi Rabbanim. They lost big, important positions and other things in Europe. You have to give the Rav all the credit in the world that he spoke his mind and his heart. He thought that Aguda was wrong, that the state of Israel is a gift from God, that the Holocaust has shown that God can make certain decisions even if the rabbis disagree. The Gedolim were opposed to Zionism, but God himself, see, after the Holocaust, the rise of the state of Israel, God himself is showing us that no. State of Israel is where we need to go. This is going to be our redemption in a physical sense and even in a spiritual sense to a certain degree. And the fact that all the rabbis, the great rabbis, disagree with it and the Mizrachi were a minority, it doesn't matter because when God votes, God automatically is the majority. Therefore, even if you have 12 brothers, 12 Gedolim saying one thing and God says the other, we listen to like God and God paskened with the creation of the state of Israel that this is the way to go. That's what he believed. Okay, that's Rav Baruch Be'er himself saying it, or then quoting Rav Baruch Be'er? I'll take a look at it. That's interesting. Remind me, Shlomo, in the next class we'll deal with Rav Baruch Be'er and Rav Chaim Ozer and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik. We'll get back to Rav Baruch Be'er, but I'll take a look at, if you have a PDF of that, if it's on, is it on HebrewBooks.org or Otzar Chachma? I will look at it, and if not, please send it to me. Did Rav Yosef Breuer refuse an offer to join the Lexus? I don't recall if he was offered it, or if he refused. They would have offered it to him. Rav Shimon Schwab, if I'm not mistaken, was on it. He was on it, so I don't know about Rav Yosef Breuer. It's already late. Let's break now. We'll pick up next class. Thank you, Shlomo. I'll check on that, and I'll get some more information for next class. And it's Hashem. Good night, everyone. Thank you very much for the comments. See you all next week.